According to the latest national polls, Hillary Rodham Clinton would almost certainly be our next president if an election were held tomorrow. A recent CNN poll has her crushing Democratic rivals, including Vice President Joe Biden, by more than 50 percentage points. And a recent Quinnipiac survey has her well ahead of her potential GOP rivals among voters in the early caucus state of Iowa. Though the former First Lady, U.S. Senator, and Secretary of State has yet to go public with a decision, there have been plenty of behind-the-scenes maneuverings to suggest a run for the presidency. Joining us this hour are Jonathan Allen, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, and Amy Parnes, senior White House correspondent for The Hill. They're also the co-authors of HRC, State Secrets, and the Rebirth of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Please join us after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for our second hour. According to the latest national polls, Hillary Rodham Clinton would almost certainly be our next president if an election were to be held tomorrow. A CNN poll has her crushing Democratic rivals, including Vice President Joe Biden, by more than 50 percentage points. And a recent Quinnipiac survey has her well ahead of her potential Republican rivals among voters in Iowa. Though the former First Lady, U.S. Senator, and Secretary of State has yet to go public with a decision, there have been plenty of behind-the-scenes maneuverings to suggest a run, including numerous public appearances and fundraising that has already netted Hillary Clinton millions of dollars. Joining me in the second hour of Midday today are two Washington political reporters to help us parse out the expected and highly anticipated Hillary Clinton presidential run. Jonathan Allen is a White House reporter for Bloomberg News, and Amy Parnes is the White House correspondent for The Hill newspaper. They're co-authors now of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Rodham Clinton, published by Crown. The book examines Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State, but also takes us inside the workings of the Clinton political machine, where loyalty is everything and betrayal marks you for life. The book recounts stories of helpful Clinton friendships and political allies, but it also sheds light on Clinton's political enemies. And yes, the Clintons did, and may still do, have a political enemies list. Overall, this book characterizes Hillary Clinton as a tough, tactical political workhorse with hard-driving ambition, someone with a dual focus, too, who never took her eyes off what was unfolding at home, even in the face of her busy overseas diplomatic agenda, hinting that she might indeed have her heart set on the presidency. As I said before, to help us talk about Hillary Clinton throughout this hour of the show, two authors, Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen. The book, again, HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. So, Amy and Jonathan, it's great to have you on Midday on WYPR. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. I've wanted to say this for a while. I'm a longtime reader and first-time caller here.
Oh, right, Jonathan. Way to go. Thank you very much. Okay, so first question, completely unoriginal, but, you know, is she running? What do you think? Is she definitely running for president?
Well, as John and I like to say, it's not whether she'll start running, it's whether she'll stop running. Yeah. We think, and we make the point in the book, that she's been running all along. She's been running since she left the Democratic primary. She was running throughout her tenure at state. And we definitely think she's in the game.
I don't think we go point by point through some of the evidence that she's been running, including thousands of thank you notes she sent out after the 2008 campaign. Not exactly what you do unless you expect to run another campaign. Some of the deficiencies in her campaign operation that she tried to address when she went into the State Department, the outreach that she had to heavy hitters in the business world while she was at the State Department, and also continuing to keep in touch with the donor class and the people who would be aides to her on a campaign or even in the White House.
Wow, she manages it all. And by the way, those thank you notes, the donor notes that you mentioned, we're talking about thousands of them, right?
Yeah, there were. I believe it was 16,000 after the 2008 campaign. There was one guy who was assigned to make sure that they were all typed out, and then he would give them to her by state, and she would go through them and make hand edits to them if she didn't like what was there, or she would sign them, cross out somebody's name right there, you know, their nickname or whatever she called them, maybe a little joke on the note. But 16,000 of them went out after that 08 campaign in June and July of 2008. So quite a hefty task. And again, the kind of thing you do if you are hoping to reach out to people and ask them for help again in the future.
You know, there was a time, maybe it was 2009 or 2010, when there seemed to be some questions about whether she would run for the presidency. You remember this, Amy? Maybe you guys never were impressed by those questions, but people raised issues about her age, for instance, how old she would be by 2016. For the record, how old will she be by 2016? But I assume from your book that you don't think any of that was true, that she's been thinking about running almost ever since 2008.
Oh yeah, like I said before, she's been constantly. I mean, I don't know if actively thinking. She obviously had a pretty heavy job going at state and was responsible for, you know, a lot of the world's affairs. But I think she had it on the mind. She was constantly following politics back home. We have one scene in the book where she was at Buckingham Palace with President Obama, and she called a congresswoman from New York who had won, and she basically let her know that she and the president had been watching her race and they had been watching the results and keeping an eye out, and they were very proud of her. So it just goes to show you, while she was abroad, she also had her pulse on what was happening back home.
And Dan, to your point about age, she'll be 69 come the swearing-in day for whoever is the president in January of 2017. Certainly something she'll hear a lot about if she runs for president. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, has already referred to Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden as the Golden Girls for 2016. So that's something, you know, and even beyond that, you've got a situation here where Republicans feel like they've got a sort of bumper crop of young folks, a next generation, if you will, whether it's Ted Cruz or Rand Paul or Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, some of those folks who they want to contrast with Hillary Clinton, even though some of the people in the Republican, the Republican field right now, as it's starting to establish itself, include some of the folks that are more her generation. Jeb Bush, obviously. I don't think anybody looks at Rick Perry as a spring chicken either. But age will be something that she'll have to talk about if she runs.
And, you know, we're often asked about it, actually, about whether or not health will keep her from the race. But, you know, John and I have been watching her actively take her. She's been kind of on her little, you know, campaign of her own, you know, talking. She's on a West Coast wing right now where she's giving speeches basically every day. And if she's able to kind of keep up that lifestyle now, I think that kind of speaks to how her health is.
Our phone number here for a midday is 410-662-8780. I put it up because it's our Tuesday political day, a second hour today devoted to the subject of Hillary Clinton with two authors of a new book about her, Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. The book is HRC, of course, the initials of Hillary Rodham Clinton, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. This is about her time as Secretary of State, but also goes into it's a tale of political resurrection, we might say. Because, I mean, did anyone think she was finished after 2008? I just want to ask you that. For all those questions that were raised about her age, about whether she would run, I don't know too many Democrats anyway who thought she was done after that election. Let's hear from Amy on that.
Well, I think that, you know, like we said, I don't think she was ever really done. And she made it a point to keep in touch with people back home. She was constantly, you know, and when she wasn't, she had what we call her secret weapon, her husband, you know, going around the country campaigning for people. So she always had her finger on the pulse of politics.
Okay. And Jonathan, what about this question? Peaking too soon. This is a very smart woman who's a very savvy politically. So it's 2014. Of course, there's a lot of talk about Hillary Clinton running in 2016. She has to get things rolling here pretty soon. Maybe she doesn't. Maybe things are already happening. But it would seem to me you don't want to, even if you think you're the likely nominee of your party, you don't want to peak too soon either, right? You don't want to come out too far with it, with anything as a candidate.
It's a tough balancing act. I think, you know, if given her druthers, Hillary Clinton would be able to run around the country you know, making money by giving speeches, which she's been doing without a whole lot of fanfare. But that's not going to happen. The news media will follow her wherever she goes. And if she were to disappear from the public stage for a while, there would be a lot of stories about where is Hillary Clinton, and then conspiracy theories about her health or what's going on with Bill Clinton. So, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot to balance if you're her people. You know, one of the things we go through in the book, though, is this sort of interesting dynamic she's got right now where there are super PACs raising money for her candidacy, which has yet to be announced. If it is announced, probably won't be announced at the earliest until the end of this year, maybe even early next year. I'm sorry, the end of this year, early next year. So even as she's not campaigning, she is traveling around the country to all kinds of different states, like you would if you were on a campaign. She's about to release a book. I assume there will be a book tour after that that takes her across the country like she's campaigning. And she's got three super PACs that are actively raising money for her right now, you know, all of which allows her, while she's saying she's not campaigning, to actually build a huge political operation.
Does anyone run against her? And this is sort of a Maryland political question. I guess you know why. We have outgoing Governor O'Malley here, who's in his last term, who supported Hillary Clinton in 2008. He's kind of avoids the question when asked publicly whether he's would run if she gets in the race. I don't think there's much of an if there anymore. But does he? I mean, what do you think happens there? If you have any insight on that, Jonathan or Amy, our own guy here in Maryland, O'Malley, and then any other candidates who might throw in 2016?
I think, you know, obviously the freeze on donors and operatives, people waiting for Hillary Clinton to make a decision, makes it more difficult for people like Martin O'Malley, who have less of a network, to really start, you know, getting going if they're going to get in a race. But if you're O'Malley and you're actually term limited as Maryland governor, I think it makes sense to start, you know, doing what you can to build, put your name in the hat, whether she runs or not, and try to distinguish yourself as the future of the Democratic Party, even if it's not for the 2016 election. And maybe, you know, maybe you get lucky and you find an issue that really activates the base. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Governor O'Malley run. You know, the question I think for him that's going to be difficult, talking to Maryland Democrats of late, is whether he's even going to have a lot of support at home for a candidacy, you know, much less across the rest of the country that's not familiar with him.
Okay. I want to do some chronology here on Hillary Clinton's life and then work up to her time as Secretary of State with our guests, Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen. And we're going to do that after our first break here in this hour of midday. Okay, so please stand by. Amy and Jonathan, we'll be back with you some more. And folks, you're entitled to ask questions here. You're entitled because it's public radio and we have phone lines and we take phone calls. If you have a question for our guests about Hillary Clinton, something you want them to speculate on or ask them about, 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. And you can send in a comment by email or a question. Email address is midday@wypr.org. More on Hillary Clinton, especially her time as Secretary of State, with Jonathan Allen, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, and Amy Parnes, White House correspondent, senior correspondent for The Hill. Their book is HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton, published by Crown. Now, a couple of things, just to go over some, you know, the recent history here. After Bill Clinton was president, First Lady Hillary Clinton became a U.S. senator in New York, and then she was picked to be Secretary of State in the Obama administration after running for president in 2008. So I just wanted to go over a couple of things that, as a sort of a refresher, if you don't mind. I mean, she was able to make that transition to U.S. Senator in New York. I guess some people accused her of being a carpetbagger, but that seemed to go away pretty fast, and she was elected. Could you just talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton's popularity generally at that time, 1998, going into the new millennium after she was First Lady? I mean, how popular was she at that time?
Well, I think that her husband left with his highest approval ratings, you know, and that's post Monica Lewinsky. Mm-hmm. But people forget about that. And she was seen as pretty popular, even though she had gone through the whole healthcare debacle. So she came in to New York, and yes, people questioned why she was there. You know, they hadn't taken up residence there. But I think she came in to the Senate sort of with this workhorse attitude, if you will, not a show horse, as she liked to say, that she was going to, you know, buckle under and do her work there and do what she needed to do and not be like the Senate star and with the spotlight. And of course, you know, wherever she goes, the media will follow. So I think that happened. But I think what you saw her do is really try to work across the aisle and work with Republicans. And they still credit her with that work to this day. If you talk to them, and we talk to a lot of them for our book, you know, they still say she actually really tried to work with us. She really tried to get stuff done, even though she had this public spotlight on her.
And Jonathan, how about when she was chosen to be Secretary of State? I just need a little refresher there. Did this create a political controversy, or was this considered a sound choice? I'm sure Republicans fought it. I'm not clear on what happened at that time.
Yeah, even the president's own advisors thought this was a crazy idea for him to go ask his former rival to join the cabinet. David Axelrod was among those advisors in a very small meeting who said to him, "How can this work? You guys just ran this really nasty campaign against each other." And Obama said, "Look, I think she's really smart. I'm going to be tied down with the financial crisis. You know, the stock market had bottomed out at that point, and the housing crisis was underway." And he said, "Look, I need somebody to be able to go out and represent the United States credibly across the world." So there was actually a long back and forth, and we go through the sort of tense moments of this in the book, where Obama's really pursuing her, and Hillary Clinton says to her staff, "You know, not for a million reasons. He's not going to ask me. I'm not going to take it." And then he does ask her, and he you know, keeps going after her. She keeps saying no, and then finally he tells her one night on the phone, "Look, if you're gonna turn this down, I need to, you know, really turn this down. I need to know, because I need to move on and ask somebody else. But don't give me an answer now. Give me a call tomorrow morning." And she finally calls him back the next morning, and she says to him, and this is really indicative of where her mind was at this point, "All right, let's talk about the conditions." Meaning she had, she'd made the decision she was going to go work for him. And, you know, we go through all of this in the book, the machinations of how they went from, enemies to friendly. They're not going down the ocean for the summer together or anything. You know, they won't be drinking beers in Ocean City. But I do think that, they do have a much better relationship, and we kind of detail that. And even to this day, there are some pretty strong staff tensions, you know, between the two worlds. And certainly, the Obama people think that they're really the top dogs, and the Clinton people, whether it's Bill Clinton's people or Hillary Clinton's people, think that they're, you know, the best at figuring things out, the best at politics, the best at strategy. So there's still some tension there, but it really is an interesting story about how it basically worked well enough that Obama, after the 2012 election, asked her on Air Force One if she would stay for another year, and she turned him down and said it was time for her to leave government service, mm-hmm. at least for now.
And her tenure as Secretary of State, we should spend some time talking about this, but I'm going to go right to Benghazi and address that right away, because I think most people listening today would say, yeah, a pretty competent Secretary of State, had a good run there, except for that Benghazi thing that Republicans keep bringing up, this tragedy at the diplomatic outpost in Benghazi. So why don't you unpack it for us both, Amy and Jonathan? What do we know about it? What was the Secretary's role in it? If she is to be criticized for any aspect of it, what would it be? So I'll start with Amy on that.
Well, first thing, I think that you're right. I mean, Republicans are going to seize on this, and they're going to keep reminding her about it over and over again. We talked to some Republicans in the book who are already kind of foreshadowing that. Sean Spicer, the head of he's head of communications at the Republican National Committee. He's already said that she can get used to seeing a Benghazi ad shown over and over again as her 3 a.m. call. But I don't know how effective it'll be. You know, we already had an election post-Benghazi. It didn't really hurt President Obama. It'll be interesting to see whether or not it hurts her. They are going to make it an issue, though. And John can maybe talk about what we unveiled in our book.
Yeah, so, Dan, the thing is, You have to start, I think, sort of at the beginning of her coming in as Secretary of State and a little bit of her philosophy of how America should do diplomacy. And one of the key components of that is the idea that we should be engaged in what's called expeditionary diplomacy. And that means having our diplomats out in dangerous places without a heavy military footprint. The idea being that it's easier for the United States to make friends, to bring people around to our way of thinking, to create alliances if it's not done at the point of a gun. And so that was a key sort of governing philosophy for her in diplomacy, particularly, you know, with a couple of wars going on and a lot of dangerous places sort of blowing up around the world. That was something she believed in. And in fact, we have a scene in the book, never before revealed, where she watches an attack at the American consulate in Peshawar, Pakistan in 2010. And it was thwarted by the defenses of the compound there, a pop-up barrier and the fast reaction of people inside. But it was a lesson, and she showed all of her top State Department advisors these images of the attack on Peshawar to make the point that these are dangerous places and that they can be defended, the American outpost, but you have to be on your toes. And so, you know, with Benghazi, it was this is Libya, a place where she had really built the coalition for intervention against Muammar Gaddafi when he was about to slaughter a lot of his own people. And she had made the case that the government there was going to be able to stand up and have something resembling a democratic free society at some point. She had a lot of stake in it in making sure that happened in Libya. It would have been her crowning achievement as a diplomat to have basically coordinated going in militarily and then standing up a government there. So over time, what happened is Benghazi got more and more dangerous, and the folks on the ground knew it, but the message wasn't being communicated effectively to the State Department. Now, whether that in Washington, was because the people on the ground weren't telling them, or the people in Washington weren't hearing it right, and I think it's more of the latter than the former. There was not an effective communication about just how dangerous it was in Benghazi. We've heard a lot about the question of whether there had been a reduction in force in the American security forces in Tripoli. And actually, you know, from what Amy and I could tell in digging through this, whether there were more or better trained security officers in Tripoli probably wouldn't have done anything to change the outcome in Benghazi, which is several hours away to the east. So, you know, once that starts happening, once the attack happens, there's probably little they could have done about it. Chris Stevens, the ambassador to Libya, was somebody who really actually subscribed to this expeditionary diplomacy idea. He was one of the real purveyors of it. He had been, he had come into Libya by cargo ship and sort of walked into Libya during the fighting in 2011. And so he was somebody who really shared that view with Hillary Clinton of how to do things. I think he was very aware that it was dangerous on the ground. I think there was a big push, as we report in the book, there was a big push to try to make the Benghazi outpost a more permanent one. It was a temporary facility. There was push from the State Department. It's been said that Hillary Clinton had told Chris Stevens that she wanted him to go out there to make sure that they could, in fact, move some money into doing that before the end of September of 2012. And so, once the attack happens, there's obviously a very, frightening situation on the ground there. There's very few Americans in Benghazi. Most of them are actually at a nearby CIA outpost. They react. They come to help, although it took about 25 minutes for them to do that. There's confusion in Tripoli, where the rest of the American contingent of diplomats is. The people in the State Department in Washington are only, they're getting the best updates they can, but nobody knows where Chris Stevens is. It turns out that he's been killed along with an information analyst. Then there's a second attack. Once they get the rest of the people out of Benghazi, the CIA team went and helped remove people from the Benghazi compound. Once they go to the CIA compound, there's a second attack. Two more people die, who are part of the Special Forces CIA contingent. And then, we talk about what's going on the ground, sort of a TikTok in the book. People can take a look at that, as well as what was going on in Washington. And, Secretary Clinton, was at the State Department until the wee hours of the morning. She was somebody who was in contact with all the other government agencies that she was supposed to be in contact with. And was and actually got in on the video conferences among the departments. So there's been a lot of talk of where were various people on that night in the national security realm. She was actually on the job that night. We're told looked very very wrought. At times during that night, in private times, this was something clearly. Was touching her pretty personally, and then we go through the sort of aftermath of it, the investigations, the talking points of Susan Rice that became such an issue, and of course the perspectives of various people, including the Republican senators who had her in as at their hearings. People might remember the moment where she said, "What difference at this point does it make?" Whether this was a terrorist attack or people just who decided, spontaneously to go attack.
Right.
So we talked to some of the senators and staffs about what they were thinking going into that hearing. We talked to folks around Hillary Clinton about how she prepared for that hearing. So, if anybody's interested in what really happened in Benghazi and what the sort of philosophy was going on, as well as the sort of nuts and bolts of what happened, before, during, and after, this book is the best place to find that, an impartial view of it.
Well, one last question on this, unless we have some others from our listeners today, and that is, there's still some dispute or a difference of opinion about whether the attack could have been prevented. It seems to me when that Senate Intelligence Committee report came out, it was a few months ago, it was in the winter, basically said that it could have been prevented, that the State Department was faulted, and then some aspects of the intelligence community were faulted, the CIA. So then that it would seem to me that since there's a difference of opinion there still, or something of a dispute, that would carry over to 2016, that those things would still be in the air. It's not, because it's not resolved, I guess is what I'm saying, Jonathan.
I think absolutely this is something that's going to be an issue in 2016. And I think, it's all sort of the layers of who's responsible. You can keep peeling them back and find new people that bear some responsibility, or you can say that everybody involved had some responsibility. I mean, obviously the terrorists, first and foremost, are the people who are responsible for the attack. Should we have known that was likely to happen? Yes. The answer is yes. If you go through all of the warning signs that were there, including any number of attacks, not just on the American facility, there were actually attacks on our facility there before, not of the same kind, improvised explosive devices, but also on other diplomats from other countries. And in fact, the British had pulled out as a result of attacks on their people there. There were attacks on, I believe, on the International Red Cross there. So, it could have been prevented in terms of pulling out, in terms of not having people there at all at a time when it was particularly dangerous. Whether that's the right strategy for American foreign policy to withdraw from every dangerous situation or to withdraw from that particular situation is another question. I don't think we'll ever have the answer as to, under what circumstances that would have happened. I think it's something that will continue to be litigated. What I don't think is that there was anybody in the State Department that thought what they were doing would lead to this outcome.
Right.
There's no, there may be negligence, there may be, there may be bad calls, bad judgment, but I have yet to see any malice from anybody in this.
One thing that we did though that was pretty interesting was we talked to people like Daryl Issa though, who is one of the lead guy, congressman, who is basically charging her with being at fault in Benghazi, and we talked to him actually right after I think in the weeks after Benghazi, and he had kind of said that it was President Obama's fault. And then after the 2012 election, we saw him sort of shift and focus more to Hillary Clinton. So that's one interesting angle in the book, that we actually deal with the politics behind Benghazi as well.
That's the voice of Amy Parnes with her colleague Jonathan Allen, co-authors of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton, published by Crown, talking about Hillary Clinton in this hour of the show, particularly her time as Secretary of State. We invited calls from our listeners at 410-662-8780 for live talk here on Midday. John is in Phoenix, Maryland, giving us a ring to make a comment about Hillary Clinton. Hello, John.
How you doing, Dan?
Good.
Yeah, I don't think she's much of a candidate at all. If you think back, and, you know, I know American memories are limited to about a week, but she was up by about 25 or 30 points back in 08. She hired a very lousy staff headed by Mark Penn to run the campaign. She was on the board of Walmart, not a favorite of, you know, left or liberal folks. She just gave a speech and got $200,000 at Goldman Sachs about, I think, last month. And she's been doing that, running around the country, telling Goldman Sachs that she's going to be on their side. Plus, the negatives that she's got going into this, I don't think she's very much of a candidate at all. And Bernie Sanders has now come out and said, after he said no, he's going to run for president. He said it a couple different times now. And that would be a formidable foe for Hillary. She's got just so much baggage.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. I'd like to get our guest comments about that. You know, the other things that we've read about Hillary Clinton lately are the speaking fees from hedge fund donors, courting Arab royalty for the Clinton Foundation for donations too, that kind of stuff. I don't know if it's rubbing anybody the wrong way, though. She seems like the inevitable candidate for the Democrats in 2016. But let's hear from our guests, Jonathan and Amy.
Well, first, I would say I agree the American memory is about a week long. I can remember a time when the University of Florida was favored to win the national championship in basketball.
Right.
I can remember when the University of Connecticut wasn't allowed to compete. So, go Maryland.
Yeah.
But I, you know, look, if Bernie Sanders wins the Democratic nomination for the presidency, I will begin eating the state of Vermont and keep going for 3 or 4 days until I fall down dead, and you can bury me in a place next to my namesakes, the Allen boys of Vermont, Ethan and Ira, et cetera. I do think, you know, as far as Hillary Clinton's candidacy and the problems that Democrats have with her, I think absolutely if she runs, those will be laid bare again. There is no question that she is more hawkish than the Democratic Party's base. There is no question. When I say the base, I don't just mean the left. I mean the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. You find the midpoint of the Democratic Party, she is far to the right of it on national security matters. She's far to the right of it on economic matters. And these are things that if she has a credible challenge in the Democratic primary, she's going to have to answer for, and she'll have to find a way to either massage it or convince people that it's okay to nominate her, even if they don't agree with her on everything. She had trouble with that in 2008. Obviously, the Iraq War Resolution vote for her, gave Barack Obama a huge opening to court the left against her last time. I do think she's a savvier candidate this time, and I do think she's in an actually stronger position as a front runner in 2016 than she was in 2008. Plus, I don't see a Barack Obama candidate, and much as I enjoy talking to Senator Sanders, I don't see him as the next Barack Obama.
I think one thing she did actually in 2008 after the primary ended was, you know, she really wanted to find out what happened, and she called aides and friends to her office and to her house, and she tried to figure out what went wrong. And so she really tried to piece together this puzzle. And one of the things she figured out was that she didn't embrace the fact that she was a woman candidate the way that Barack Obama embraced the fact that he's African American. And I think that that's one of the things that you see her do in 2016 and before, you know, that she's going to talk about history being made and that people don't want to be on the wrong side of history, kind of taking a page from Barack Obama in 2008.
You seem to make the point in the book, Amy and Jonathan, that she doesn't seem to be aware of her own popularity, or doesn't seem to be aware of how passionately some people feel about her.
Well, we did. There's one scene in the book where, she actually had very high approval ratings when she was Secretary of State, but she was talking to Ellen Tauscher, a congresswoman at the time, where, you know, and Ellen Tauscher was kind of saying, yes, you're popular now, but you aren't, once you wade back into politics, you're going to see your popularity kind of decrease. And that's what we've seen actually lately. When we've seen her, you know, hitting the road and making these speeches, you know, her popularity has sunk in a little bit. It'll be interesting to see how that, you know, shapes out once she announces.
Do you think she fully appreciated how important it was, that because she was a woman running for president, how important that was to so many voters?
I think she really didn't for a long time. There was, during the campaign, it was something she rejected talking about. Barack Obama talked constantly about the historic nature of his candidacy, and certainly his supporters and surrogates did that. She didn't talk about the historic nature of her candidacy very much during the campaign. First woman to win primaries, and certainly the most credible female candidate for the presidency that the United States had seen. In fact, we have a scene in the book, I think it's very, very sort of telling, right before she gives her concession speech in 2008 to the concession to Obama. She sits down at her table with the final draft, or what's close to a final draft, with a couple of her aides, and she starts reading through it. And there are a couple of lines in there about her place as a woman, and sort of congratulating the women who went along with her campaign for the ride, and were seeking to break a glass ceiling. And she's reading through this, and she draws a question mark in the margin around that part of the speech. And they go through it, and she comes back to it. And she says to her aides, this really wasn't about me being a woman. Hmm. And one of the it was a male aide and a female aide. And the male aide says to her, well, think about it more like you're talking to your supporters. You're acknowledging their accomplishment in getting you so far down the road. Hmm. And she's still not really buying it. And then finally, the young woman who's her speechwriter, Sarah Hurwitz, kind of leans forward in her chair and basically makes the case that, this is the moment to finally embrace this, that these people really had cared deeply about seeing the first woman elected president, and it would be a rejection if Hillary Clinton didn't embrace that publicly. So she says, okay, it stays. And then the next day, of course, everybody heard that line that folks remember about having put 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling, the number of votes she had gotten in the Democratic primary. I think it took her a long time to recognize how meaningful that was to so many people, to so many women who are watching her candidacy. And I don't think it's something that she will ignore this time around.
Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes, co-authors of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. It's Hillary Watch 2016, an inside look at how Hillary Clinton reversed her political fortunes after 2008 and how she might govern as the next president. After a short break, we'll come back and talk to Jonathan and Amy some more, particular as to a few questions about her relationship with Bill Clinton in public life. If you have a question, please give us a ring here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And welcome back as we hear about Hillary Rodham Clinton from two Washington journalists, Jonathan Allen, White House reporter for Bloomberg News, and Amy Parnes, senior White House correspondent for The Hill. As we talk about the former First Lady, former U.S. Senator, now former Secretary of State, and possibly future President of the United States. 410-662-8780 is our number. I know this is a big question, Hillary Clinton's, I would say, public relationship with Bill Clinton, what we know about how he might have influenced or not influenced her work as Secretary of State, as U.S. Senator, as a person who gives speeches. I know Bill Clinton has done some editing of Hillary Clinton's speeches, or maybe a speech in particular. But we should talk a little bit about old Bill and Hillary over these years. Amy, you want to take that?
Sure. Well, I think the one speech you were referring to was in Denver in 2008. Senator Clinton at the time was about to give this great big speech in Denver, you might recall, to kind of rally Democrats behind Barack Obama. And so she's preparing to do that. She goes to the arena. She practices. She comes back and she's practicing the speech again and looking at it. And she notices that there have been some changes. And she basically looks at her aides and says, "What happened?" And they said, "The president was here, and he added some of his poetic flourishes." And she looks at them and she says, "It's my speech." And she leaves the room to go find her husband. And that was, we thought that was a very revealing moment, because it kind of showed how the two sides come together, how he's still very much a part of what she does. She's still very much a part of what he does.
But they are wedded.
So what about the final draft of that speech, Amy?
So she basically instructs her aides to put it back together the way it was. And she keeps some of the flourishes because, you know, he is one of a kind in the way he speaks to people. And we saw that in 2012 when he addressed Democrats in Charlotte and he said, you know, he basically boiled it down to arithmetic and spoke to the middle class in a way that President Obama couldn't and really no one else in the Democratic Party could. And so I think that if she does use him in the way that President Obama used him in 2012, talking to bigger crowds, not really speaking to the press one-on-one, which she doesn't really like to do that much anyway, then it'll be very effective for her.
Jonathan, you think of what an unusual situation this would be, hypothetically speaking, down the road, if she were elected first a nominee. Let's say she actually won a general election in November of 2016 and became president of the United States, the former first lady, now president of the United States, married to a former president who served two terms. I mean, that's pretty unique in our history. I just think, and I wonder, you know, I wonder if it gives anybody any pause, you know, in terms of who are you voting for? We note that Bill Clinton was very popular. Amy said it at the end of his term, despite the Monica Lewinsky thing, very popular then. I think he's the most popular former president that we have now. The people, I guess you'd have to go out and do a poll if people separate the two sufficiently enough. Does Hillary Clinton ever feel upstaged by him?
I think the answer is that Hillary Clinton has probably felt upstaged by him for many, many years now. this is a political marriage between two pretty, you know, pretty competent, pretty strategic, pretty capable people. Mm-hmm. If you were to define power couple, I know it's a term from, you know, the 80s or 90s, the power couple idea, because now it's so normal for men and women to have sort of, you know, parity in their relationships or both be, you know, sort of ascending the professional ladder. But this is the ultimate power couple in American politics. And, I think that he has upstaged her. To answer a question that you didn't ask, but a lot of people do, what they would call him if she were elected president is Mr.
Did we lose our line to Jonathan? Jonathan, Amy? Well, we'll try to get it back. Let's try to get it back, and we'll see what we can do here. Boy, he was right in the middle of answering a question I didn't ask, but I would like to know the answer to what would you call Bill Clinton should Hillary Clinton be elected president? Dean and Timonium actually called in to make a comment about this, so while we're hoping to get back in touch with Jonathan and Amy to talk about Hillary Clinton, why don't we take this call? Dean, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, well, you have excellent timing because I just lost my two guests, I hope temporarily. Go right ahead, Dean. What did you want to say about Hillary Clinton?
In 2006, Hillary came to my New York district to campaign for my congressman. I shook hands with her afterwards and invited her to come and stay at my inn. She took out a pen, made a note of the name of the inn. A year later, she and Bill came to stay at the inn. My wife got in conversation with her and mentioned that her mother, who was 85 years old and lived in Kentucky, was a great supporter of Hillary. Hillary took out a pen and wrote a note to my mother-in-law. A year later, after she was Secretary of State, she and Bill came back to stay at the inn. I happened to be in the hospital. I left a note welcoming her. She sent me a thank you note. There's absolutely no way that I would not vote for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, it was a great political move. Dean, where was that? You said, where in New York was that?
It was upstate New York. The inn is called the Emerson Inn. It's outside of Woodstock.
Huh. And she was she a senator then?
At first she was a senator, and then she was Secretary of State.
Yeah, no, I know that. But, I mean, she was a senator campaigning for your local Congress candidate for Congress. Is that it?
Marie Cinci, a Democrat,
A freighter and or sink it, maybe as part of the same scheme, in order to throw people off his trail. He didn't have ID. There was no way he could fly out of the country. He couldn't drive a car. He got to Baltimore by getting people to drive him and so on. So his options were limited.
What was it like when you spoke with him in prison?
It was one of the scariest things I've ever done, because here I am looking through this pane of plexiglass at a guy who I last saw as Clark Rockefeller, you know, a blue blazer and a bow tie or whatever. And here he is in prison garb, and I know that not only did he kill somebody, he chopped him up into pieces and wrapped him in plastic and buried him in a yard and played a game on the grave. And I'm looking into his eyes from 4 inches away through this pane of glass, and I see what I know to be the most monstrous individual I've ever met in my life. And it frightened me.
Did you? When was the last time you had a conversation with him? Was it
after
the conviction, or were these all before the conviction?
No. You see, he wasn't allowed by his attorneys to talk to anyone after his kidnapping trial in 2008. And he was only convicted of murder exactly a year ago. He fired his lawyers, and then suddenly he was available for visits. So I started visiting him exactly a year ago. The last time I saw him was August 25th, 2013, after his sentencing. And his first words to me, because he knew I was writing about him, were, "You betrayed me." You know, he turned it around on me.
You betrayed him.
I betrayed him.
How did you betray him? Writing about him?
Yeah, a gentleman apparently didn't tell secrets, you know. By that time, I didn't care. I mean, I'm going to tell you honestly, a lot of this book is motivated by anger and a sense of wanting to turn the tables on somebody who took advantage of me.
Well, that feeling of betrayal,
yeah,
right? Is it part of that feeling of having been had?
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to fess up to, actually. As you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of people who knew Clark Rockefeller who won't admit to it today.
You know, there's a phrase in the world of con artistry called cooling out the mark. It means, after you've taken somebody's trust, you calm them down before you take off. You know, he never got a chance to calm me down. When I found out what a fake he was, the anger remained fresh until I watched him convicted of murder. And he took away my ability to walk down the street and trust the people I meet, to go on the internet and, you know, trust that the Facebook friend is really who they say they are. You know, people say, "What did he steal from you? He didn't steal money." No, he stole my faith in other human beings.
Do you really feel that today? I mean, like,
to
when you drive around in your truck or whatever, you see.
To some extent. Yeah, I mean.
Encounter somebody new, maybe? You're a little more leery than you were before?
Oh, obviously. I mean, I remember a few months after he was outed, a plumber saying, you know, "Give me your key while you're on vacation. I'll come in and fix your pipes." And I couldn't do it. You know, I just. It's subtle, but once you've been taken, you're not the same person.
We should say that Christian Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, is serving a sentence of 27 to life. Is that right?
Well, life is actually 27 years in his case. That's what that's what a life sentence is in California. And he's talked himself into a minimum security prison, though, I hear, as of a couple weeks ago, which is crazy.
His story to you about the murder is the wife, Linda, did it and disappeared.
Yeah.
Is that right?
He was kind of like O.J. in jail. You remember how O.J. said he had a team of investigators who were going to find out who really killed his wife? Well, Clark in jail said, Linda did it, and we know where she is. Maybe you'll help find her. I don't know who "we" was supposed to be, him and his attorneys.
Walter, did he present any of that at his trial and his defense?
No. No.
So they didn't even raise that theory.
No. I guess. Well, they did suggest she did it, but they never went into how or where she might be hiding. And the prosecution did a good job of proving that since that day when her husband disappeared, not a blip had ever come up in any record anywhere in the country of Linda's existence. So she's gone. She's gone.
Walter Kern is the author of Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade, the story of Carl Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, and his long, unsuspecting friendship with him. Walter, this has been great, and it's a great book. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Great story. Thank you very much for visiting us.
Fun talking here.